Welcome to episode 18 of the Sign Radio Show. We answer an audience question about music competitions, and IQ joins us to tell about the history of Shady Toy and how the scene helped his spectacular career.
Welcome to the Design Radio Show, episode 18. I'm Aki.
And I'm Zephoid.
And we kick it off. We have Axel later in the show with an interview with IQ. And it's going to be super exciting. But first, I'm here with Zephoid, and it's our 11th episode.
That's massive.
It's massive. We've been doing this for 11 episodes. So that's cool.
Yeah, that's true. Because you kind of not count the previous ones, the previous batch.
The previous counts are like there for like historic reasons, but I think they were a different time, a different mindset, I think podcasts were still, as we said before, podcasts were a new thing back then, so it was more a radio show.
Yeah.
I kind of feel they're there, but I always, when I tell people that that is a podcast, you can just do, ignore the old episodes, start with the, because I think these are like, it's a different take, especially thanks to Gargai and Gloom editing them is so much more professional, but still shout out Vincenzo for doing the previous ones, because they were really fun.
Yeah, I do. I actually listened back to the episodes when coming on to help you guys with it. And I must say that I really appreciated those as well. But then they had music, and yeah. That was good in my book.
Yeah, it was a radio show. And I think they were fun, but also I was kind of a different person back then. Like, I changed over the years, and I hear myself say things. I'm like, ooh. So that's the same thing. Like, you learn, and you own it up, but I feel like they're there. You can listen to them if you want to, and then give us feedback, because we would love to hear from you. And we did. We got a question.
Yes.
Question from PS, asking us about themed music competitions. And he's like, music compos on demo parties. He feels like people have not been participating, caring about them. I don't think that's fully true, but there is a trend of having themed compos, which there have been, like, more themed music competitions in the last few years, from Evoke's themed Tracker music compo to the Acid compo at Trasak, the Boost Drum, the Gabber compo in Finland during Assembly, Inertia, the Drone compo. So it's like, did they lose interest, and the themed compos bring it back? What do you think, Zephoid?
I do like the fact that there are themed compos. Occasionally, I like the freebasing as well, of course, because I mean you can do whatever you want, but it's always another challenge to have a specific theme that you need to stick to, and I think it can bring something to the table. However, it doesn't always have to be. So I would not favor that to be the full extent of the compos, but definitely have that part of it as well. And I mean, we see a lot of participation overall in the music compos these days, so it's not a bad thing at all.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, especially like I remember for Evoke, for example, the themed Tracker music compo came from the Tracker music compo. They first had it used to be a 32 kilobyte, like tiny Tracker compo. They always had their songs at a size limit. Evoke has been doing it for years.
Yeah.
And then they changed it to having a theme, and they had some different themes. Some were better than others, I think. They changed their vibe, and they had themed music compos. First, it was like only use the I'm Not on the Top of Playboy sample for all your samples. That actually had some crazy awesome results. I remember H, I haven't seen him in ages, please come back. It was a Swiss demo scener. And he managed to get a breakbeat out of I'm Not on the Top of Playboy. That was like
That's incredibly impressive.
Fun.
Yeah.
And that might also have been, I don't think that was the first time JCO broke that music compo, but that was when there was only use a sine wave, and he just made a Renoise that basically emulated an MP3 because he just wrote a script to do that.
Yep.
Evo compo rules, as he always says, because he always do that as soon as he's allowed to put a sine wave in. And then we did a remix, the soundtrack from Da Clone by Halcyon, which, if you don't know, it's a demo by Halcyon made by Croker, where the soundtrack is basically a song that has a blah, blah, blah sound and a beat loop from Croker himself and a beat loop sample, so that was only use those samples, and that was a really fun compo. But then the second year we did another one of those remix compos. It was another song, the Hex Appeal soundtrack from Zodiac, and that was just like, yeah, now you just have like 9 remixes of that song. and that's just a very like song and not like a fun sample. So it just that is also the risk of like doing a themed compo. And I think with a theme, like people focus on that. And you saw it at Trisak with the acid compo that all the other music compos had like way less entries because everybody focused on the acid music compo.
Yeah, which is also a thing. Because of life, I mean, you can't really participate in everything anyway. So it's good that you choose. But yeah, well, it is attractive, acid music compos, for instance.
Yeah. But it becomes the bigger thing because I always find like music compos, especially tracker music, I have the feeling it's coming back like a little bit, like for the online revisions. Like usually at revision, we would have like 12, 13 tracker entries. It was a safe bet to enter the tracker music compo and be played. That's why I always participated because I would always be pre-selected in MP3 because I'm just not good enough. Mm. And there were also 80 entries. So like that's like, not just to be like so sad about myself, but it's just like, yeah, that's huge competition. And tracker is... like that was less entries, but now for the last few revisions, I think we had loads of tracker entries from all over the world. Actually, external people also coming in. So that was also in the question of like, do themed compos bring in external people? I think people have been finding the demo scene again. So maybe, but it kind of burdens it. But as an extra compo, it's fun. But then you have a lot of music compos, and music compos are always kind of. A lot of non-musicians find them boring.
then it's a good thing that the scene is actually, well, populated by a lot of musicians as well. So that's good. I mean, speaking as two of us in this sense. But
in this podcast, we have 100% musician count producing this podcast with musicians that also do other things. But well, let's be fair, we're all musicians, like even Garga and Gloom are known to dabble in music a little bit here and there.
Occasionally.
But I find myself at a music compo, especially revision, the tracker music compo, first compo of the party, you sit there in front of the screen with only musicians. It's always fun. Like, I love it.
Yeah.
But other people treat it as like, yes, nice background music, which I think is also fine. I think that's also good. It's nice.
Yeah, it works. I mean, it is often the start of the party anyway, and people are still building up their system. I mean, even though it's usually on the second day, for revision, for instance, it is. But, I do like the music compos, I must say. But it also, it needs to be handled in a good way. For instance, at the X party, I think they have a rule of not canceling any entries at all. I mean, they allow basically all entries, but that can take... well, quite a while to play through. I think at some X party we had 52 tracks or something, SIDS. It's like, it took a while. So that's why I feel like it could be an additional combo. Yeah. Like, for instance, you had this a couple of years ago at Revision, you had this, you should make an airline commercial or something like that. That was an additional combo. That would work. I would not choose a themed compo in favor of a normal compo at a party. That's not, my pick.
No, I agree. Like if you have to pick, like it's kind of what evoked it with the tracker music compo. It's like we'll have a tracker music compo, but it will be themed.
Yeah.
So if you do tracker music, you kind of have to stick to that, and that is kind of like it has always worked. But you kind of limit yourself. Mm. So yeah, because we have a lot of music composed. Like in general, there's quite a lot of music at demo parties, and there is this distinction between technical streaming and indeed like tracker.
Yeah.
We don't really do a genre split.
No, that's true. I mean, Assembly is trying to do that with their dance music versus what's the regular? It's just streaming music.
Listening.
No, listening.
Listening
yes.
music.
But that's also a distinction that it's not easy to make. I mean, that's the problem with generalizing, I guess.
So we find, because we did it now, when I said it, I remember that back in the early days when, in the 90s in the Netherlands, we had a house compo and music compo, because house music is not music. And a house compo was everything from like breakbeats to gabber to mellow house to like dance. And because they got too many entries and they kind of wanted to have that split, but you make it, it's very subjective to say like, this is, I think dance music and listening music is a little bit clearer, but genres is hard. And I think you also get a kind of boring compo. But then again, the themed compo is only acid maybe, or only gabber, like in Boozodrome. So,
That's true. But I mean, it is a different story. I mean, just talking from my experiences when gathering tracks for the Sound of Scene Set volumes, I don't generalize that. I don't control the genres of what people are making, but it also makes sense because it is a hard thing to actually bundle them into sort of genre sections of the compilation. So it is hard to compare. I mean, it's a lot easier to compare in a technical level because you say you have the executable thing. You need to be able to run it on a computer with it, that size limit. And then it doesn't matter how it sounds or what kind of style it is. So yeah, it is different to separate it by technical versus genre. That's for sure.
But I think I agree that I wouldn't want a themed compo to take over a regular music compo. I'd rather hear, although I love the Trisec music compo, it can be DJ'd because it's all in the same style. You could say that for every music compo, but I think that was also a big perk of, like, I think both Hoffman and Laguber mixed the acid compo live, and that's really fun. And Ronnie did it for, like, the full-time streaming music compo DJ sets.
Yeah.
Eddie Vogue. No Vogue or Pro Vogue or like the
Vogue something.
And also for him, that was for him, because I've done pre-selections with Ronnie and he can be quite harsh, but that was the moment he was like, I'm playing everything because this is for the DJ set and I'm just going to get every song in there.
That's really good.
Different though. Vibe as well.
Yeah, I mean, I must say that I appreciate the DJ'd set as well, because I mean, it shows how the music can be used at the mind by the fingers of another creative mind in that sense.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it puts the music in a certain context, and you have to make it in a certain style as well. I mean, you kind of, like, he was like, you have to do it in a certain BPM, and I don't think the style, I think it was breakbeat, but it was kind of liberally used. But I love, and also the fact that the downside is you don't get your whole song played, but it's like you'll be in there, and that's also awesome.
Yeah.
So I think we have a lot of interesting things happening in music competition. So I don't think the compos are dying. I think themed compos are definitely helping.
Yeah.
But let's respect the music competition, and let's all be there in front of the screen at revision.
Yes, please.
For the tracker music compo, for the first compo of the party, and enjoy the bleeps and the downsampled pianos, because it's just really fun.
Yeah, it's not a bad idea at all. I mean, let's just keep participating. I haven't participated in a music compo since like 2012 or something like that, but at least or Datastorm 2014 or something. But at least there was something. Okay.
So, and then something else maybe I wanted to talk about, because that was on my mind, is we had a few demo parties.
Yes.
And there was the Assembly Online Creative Convention.
Oh, I missed that one. Was it any good?
I think it was pretty good. Mm-hmm. I think there was a lot of fun entries there. I also don't want to miss, like, there was Deadline happened in real life that was fun and that was good. Great entries all around. I mean, this year is, again, good for entries, but there was a demo released at Assembly, and it was called, it's from The Palm, and it's Death Room.
The Planet of Leather Movements. I do like that group name, though. The Palm, I was like,
it's a fantastic group name. The Planet of Leather Movements. Yeah. Not just any movement. Yeah. The Leather Movements. I still don't know where it comes from. Let us know. And we can discuss it on the next episode.
Yes.
Origin of group names. And how the hell does this happen?
Nice topic.
Planet of Leather Movements. Might actually be an interesting topic. Let's discuss it with our producer when we're done.
Yes.
But there was a demo made by Feather, and Feather is, in my opinion, like, is a great designer. He's fantastic, and the music by Croker. But it was made in Notch, and pretty much all the assets were like from an asset store.
Yeah. So,
like, that's a little borrowed content.
Yeah, that's always a tough topic. I mean, I know that a lot of people are extremely elitist when it comes to, no, you should make everything in your demo, building it and everything like that. I'm not really that purist in that sense, because I do like the fact that you can use a framework like Notch or I mean Unity or whatever, and then do the creative parts of the bits of the demo, because not everyone can create a massive 3D engine, for instance, or can do that. But then also you should always consider the fact that just because you have a framework or an editor to work in, it doesn't automatically make the demo for you. I mean, it's sort of like people saying, it's so easy to make music these days. You have these tools that create everything by the click of a button. It's not really that simple.
Yeah, but I think it's for the engines. We already, like, you don't have time to make your own 3D engine, and those times are kind of behind us, like back in the early times you made. And I think there's still absolutely, like, love for doing that, and I think it should be, like, it's always like, how do you judge a demo made in Unreal or made in Unity or made in Notch versus a demo made in a bit wrong. But then with the content, I mean, at one point, and that is also something like back in the day, people would just rip off Boris Vallejo.
Yeah,
true. Or any kind of magazine image. And we kind of like, we're like, that's fine. I mean, you still put it on an Amiga, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And I think for this, is because I, to be honest, like the demo as it stands, Death Room has 27 thumbs up and one thumb down and six piggies. And the piggies are also mostly about like, you use a lot of stock content, but it's a good demo. So it's not being bombed for
that's
it.
That's good.
Let's get that clear. But I feel like if this participates next to somebody that made everything themselves, it's kind of like, okay, cool. You directed some stuff together really well. And even that is sometimes it's a little bit incoherent even, but it's I mean, I love the demo, and especially the soundtrack is fantastic, and it looks really good together.
Mm.
But then compared to somebody that really worked on everything, it's kind of like, how do you judge that? Is that like, does this get unfair at one point?
I guess it does, actually. But it's also a tough call on who's to judge what level of own creation you need to have. Should we have original demo compo and then put together by stock stuff demo compo? I don't know. I think that this is more for the organic discussions afterwards kind of thing.
Yeah, I feel like it's just, we've had this when Machinima came up, we've had this when Engines came up, and a demo for me is always like somebody made something really cool you can run real time on your computer. Because that was originally the basis for it, and that's a demo.
Mm.
But it will set like the standard will be like, oh, but somebody can. I remember it was the Finnish joke group Expert made a demo, which was made in Unreal with a bunch of assets and like with a soundtrack, and that was like a disassembly kind of as a pull on that. Mm-hmm. It was like, look at how good we can make this look with like barely any effort, but it's still effort because it's not. I guess you said it's not that easy.
Yeah.
And I feel like Death Room is probably very high in my favorite demos of 2021.
Yeah, I mean,
but I'm also a little bit like, but is it, would it have been like a stock video? I really appreciate the work that Feather and Croker did. And I'm happy they did it with the tools and the content they got.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, it might. I mean, I did recognize it because I don't have that good eye for stock stuff in the various platforms, and I just seen it quickly though, and it felt quite nice, especially the soundtrack. Yes, the soundtrack brought it to my attention. I felt it kind of didn't lead anywhere completely. It was just a lot of loose ends, not entirely thought through the whole process, so it didn't take me all the way through, but it was really nice though. And I mean, yes, it looks beautiful technically as well.
But
that's
to be fair, that's kind of it. It's like a bunch of scenes, like it's tied together by the color scheme, it's tied together by the soundtrack.
Yeah.
To credit, it gives like credit to all the assets used at the end of the demo.
That's
it gives like a big list of like, we got all these things come from here.
Yeah.
So it's also open about it. Like, we use this because we wanted to make something and we can't do everything ourselves.
Yeah.
So we use all these bits.
And that kind of validates it for me enough, to be honest.
It makes it better. Yeah. Like, it makes it better than not saying it. Like, oh, I made a demo. Look at how cool it is. I secretly stole everything. But then again, everybody gets inspired. And we've had these discussions over and over where you see a cool Vimeo video and you kind of emulate that Amiga like TBL did, and everybody gets inspired by something. So at one point it goes like, what do you feel is more important? That these two guys made a fantastic looking visual show for us to watch and just used the means they got to do it as though they wouldn't have?
Yeah. I'd say that's a validation for me, at least.
Yeah, I'm happier they made something than that they didn't make it because they couldn't make everything themselves.
Yeah.
But then judging it against something that somebody made fully...
That's tougher.
So, yeah, I think it's... We're all like, we have to like use our mind. And I think the demo scene is pretty good at like judging, as a fairly harshly judged. I mean, this was second at Assembly.
Okay.
In the combined demo. So, but yeah, if I look at the results, I think it's hard. Like, if you're in that compo and you're under, like you're lower than this demo, and you kind of go like, cool, but I feel like it kind of rubs, and it's indeed like we judge a lot of the demo scene.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, is it good judging or is it just judging?
That's
and also is that part of it?
It's partly it as well. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Everybody yelling at like, oh, the results of this demo party are wrong. It's like, yeah, well, people vote in the mindset they have. Demo parties are late. People are maybe inhibited.
Yep.
And winner demo wins. I still feel winner demo won fair and squarely because the crowd was ready for that demo. And that is the way the demo scene is. Like, it's... So crowd pleasers, everything. Very this true. Whole discussion again.
Yeah, and we do have quite a lot of old men yelling at clouds in the demo scene overall. So that's true.
And different clouds.
Yeah,
that's the thing. Is like it's a different cloud for everybody else. Like I'm very open to like if you make a demo, you make a demo, and you're awesome, and I'm happy, and I love you, and show it to me.
Yeah.
And you have to start somewhere, and I know how hard it is because I can do shit. Like I can make music, but like as soon I tried cables.
Mm-hmm.
And I really want to make a demo in cables, and I'm gonna learn it, but it's so much harder than people think it is if you have a tool. So I love it. But at one point you go like, okay, what is a demo then, but not an artistic outing? And then a lot of people go like, but I joined the demo scene for this, or I joined the demo scene for that aspect of it. And I think as long as we touch everything, we're good.
Yeah.
I'm rambling, but that's because I'm old.
Yeah, yeah. And you're allowed to, because I didn't really join the demo scene for any particular reason more than, hey, fun stuff is happening. What's this? This is cool. And then music, well, was brought into my attention. It was like, yeah, this I can hang with this. I could like this. And but yeah, there are, of course, sides to everyone's story. So, but.
Yeah, and I love everything. Again, like we might have talked down a little bit. It feels like we might have talked down on nostalgia and people doing certain things. Like I really appreciate everybody doing the thing they love to do and to show it to everybody. I mean, absolutely get that clear.
Yes.
And that's why I also love the poem demo, because it's clearly a lot of love made with a lot of passion to show to people at assembly. So, and speaking about like indeed nostalgia and things, let's talk to somebody that also has opinions about a lot of things in the demo scene and has a really great track record in the demo scene, and we're going to talk to him about it.
Yes.
Let's see what he has to say about all this. Our guest this week is IQ, a Scene.org and Meteoric Award-winning coder from RGBA, who's best known for creating Shader Toy, as well as his educational work. Outside the scene, he is a recipient of the 2013 Visual Effects Society Award. And we're very happy to have you on the show. Welcome, IQ.
Thanks for having me.
Looking forward to chat to you. We have many, many questions to you, and actually to dive right in with Shader Toy, because I think that Shader Toy is the thing people probably know you from the most. Like, is the
mm-hmm.
So what was the motivation behind creating Shader Toy, setting that up?
I think it was... mostly, so that was in 2009, the first iteration of it, which still is in Poet, I think.
That's the product. Entry. Fair enough.
Yeah. And that was the year I left Europe to come to California, and I couldn't go anymore to the demo parties. So that was my little way of continuing connected with demo scene, and especially for the with the 4 kilobyte size coding spirit, I guess. So basically, I created a website, which was, that was the same year that WebGL was released, which is the technology that powers browsers and allows them to do 3D. So I created the website, and I was at the time asking individuals that I knew from the demo scene to send me code of their 4K intros. And they would send them to me by mail, and I would put them online. And I think I collected 20 or 25, 4K intros. And and it grew from there, basically. At some point in 2013, I think, my colleague Paul Jeremias, who is another Spaniard, not demo sceneer, but always, he has always been in computer graphics and doing games and things. Mm-hmm. We together kind of pushed Shader Toy to the next iteration, which is the one that everyone knows today. And the main difference between the first iteration and the second one was the sense of community. We created forums, and people not could only see the source code or the demos, which was basically what I wanted to... So basically, I guess there are like different things. One was the need to do more demo-style things. The other one is to create a community. And the other one was to share code, which is something that even though demo sceners had been doing in some form, especially in the seminars in, in the breakpoint, where they would, you know, show the insights of their demos and reveal some of the secrets. Still, for the most part, there wasn't a culture of sharing source code. So I thought ShaderToy could be that, the place where you share your code, but still in a competitive way, you know, in the demo scene way, where you still try to do your best and impress anyone and everyone. And but at the same time, being online, which is a way to very easily reach a lot of people. And actually, as a result of that, I think we got many demo sceners on board, but also many non-demo sceners, especially people from academia, like teachers and people who are studying computer graphics, game developers, people like that, that otherwise wouldn't have even considered doing size coding or procedural content, but that now are enjoying that kind of little competition that we have going continuously and all the time in ShaderToy. Yeah.
How do you describe ShaderToy to someone outside of the demo scene, like people you come across from completely different backgrounds?
If it's someone who is into computer graphics, then it's easy. If it's no one, if it's someone who doesn't know anything about computer graphics, then I explain something like, this is the YouTube of crazy mathematical and procedural computer graphics, which maybe doesn't help much then, but it's like a place where nerds go to show their artistic and coding skills. So that would be the, for my mom, kind of explanation. For someone who comes from filmmaking or games, it's much easier, right? You just explain, well, this is a place where you can share your creations, you can learn from others, you can ask questions, you can challenge each other. It's much easier.
Especially that, like, especially the openness of it all, because as you said, like, it has a big following. Like, it was very quickly, I think, huge follow. Do you know how big the community is at this point? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to measure because, I mean, we have numbers, of course, of how many users with a password there are that log in every now and then. And that's about 120,000, I think. So that's a lot. But that doesn't
mean I was wondering
that,
where you were going with it, like 100, like 100. 20,000, okay.
Yeah. But that doesn't mean that everyone is, it's not like everyone is adding content.
No, no, fair enough.
So there's a big percentage of viewers. And then, but still, I would say there's a solid 10, 20K people who are actively injecting content.
Actively developing for it. Yeah, that's huge. Did you ever expect it to be that big to be
no,
that successful?
No, I didn't even know there were so many nerds in the world that would be willing to do graphics and maths and these kind of things. No, but it's been growing a lot. Also, lately, although this is more in the people who watch versus the people who contribute, but we got a lot of viewers lately from China. The website has exploded. Basically, now ShaderToy is a Chinese website almost.
Wow.
In that 80% of the traffic comes from China.
Do you know why? Or have no idea why that is?
I think these are students who are learning computer graphics and things like that. But still, the creators are mostly Western.
Right.
So they are in the watching. We are in the creation. For now.
Okay. We'll for now, yeah, for now.
That changes.
Yeah, let's see when that explodes. It'll be awesome. There's so much new content will be added. Yeah.
But this has been very recent. This has been the last year.
Interesting. Yeah, maybe just a pickup of getting discovered.
Yeah.
And what do you see ShaderToy as primarily? Like, is it a platform? Is it a community? Is it an educational resource? A code repository? A sandbox? Or maybe all of those things?
I think it's all of those things. So there's the tool aspect because people and I use it to prototype things. It's the community. It's the educational platform. But educational for people who learn by watching others. We don't give explanations, really. It's not like there are tutorials or anything, but for those who can learn from watching others, then this is a great educational platform. But I don't see it as a code repository, which is something I've been trying to... So for me, ShaderToy is more like a gallery, an art gallery, than a repository. And that's why, even though we allow it, we don't encourage forking and copying and doing derivatives of another shader, unless you are contributing with something meaningful in code or algorithmically or visually, artistically. So every time someone just decides to, you know, clone two or three shaders from someone else, we send them a message like, hey, this is great. If you did that to learn and to play with that shader and break it without destroying the original and keep it private, we are considering this more of a gallery kind of thing. But at the same time, I cannot really enforce that vision. So many people see it more as a repository.
Do you have any kind of moderation? Because you have a lot of users, it seems like.
Yeah, but for the most part, it's very well behaved. People, I mean, I moderate, me and Paul, and that's it.
Wow.
But there's not much to moderate because, again, I think from the beginning we said this culture of you don't make copies, and I don't know what, I wouldn't know how to replicate it, but for some way we managed to grow the community from a very, I don't know, well-behaved core of users, and it grew from there, and it's like a pearl, you know, like you put a bit of sand and the thing grows from it, and it takes the shape of the original object. So I guess because the original group of people that we invited by hand, which was mostly demo sceners,
right,
they knew how to behave and respect each other, and they had appreciation for art, and I don't know, the community grew from there, and it doesn't need much moderation.
That's awesome, actually. I hope that we don't like break that now with this podcast. That people are like, oh, that's shared, let's break it. Don't. Be nice, because it's awesome, especially in this world like the internet, where it's hard to like keep things nice, that this is actually something where that works really well and people are respectful. And
it is working. Yeah. And then the users themselves, like the thing I was saying of telling people not to clone a shader just for the sake of cloning it. I don't always have to do it myself. Other users do it as well and tell them.
Right. And are there people that you've seen grow within Shader Toy that joined and then became really good and because of learning and that, like,
yeah,
has there
absolutely
been like these people that you've like are proud of? And
yeah there is quite a few, actually. There's one 15 years old, One Shade, I think is his nickname, who joined in asking a lot of questions like, how do you solve this thing with math? And now he's doing amazing shaders on his own.
Awesome.
We also have people like Paul Malin, who was not a demo scener. He was a game developer from the UK, Activision, I want to say, he used to work. Mm-hmm. And through Shader Toy, I think, he joined the demo scene now, and he released that 4K procedural graphics at Inertia demo party, was it? It was the cup of tea.
That was awesome. Yeah.
He was a game developer until, I mean, I think this is his first demo scene production. He kind of joined through Shader Toy.
That's great.
A game developer that through Shader Toy got into the demos. It's like the reverse game development story, basically, where you start in the scene back in the day, you get into the games. But that's awesome, because, how is the makeup of the community? Because, as you said, like, there were a lot of demo sceners in the beginning,
mm-hmm.
but I guess now it outnumbers, the sceners are outnumbered. I presume there's way more people that are not demo scene affiliated or...
Yeah. I mean, imagine with that amount of users we have, I don't think there is all those many demo sceners. I think it's mostly... We haven't run, you know, polls, or we haven't sent emails to the users asking who they are or anything, but just from... anecdotal, just from sampling people randomly at conferences, at events, and things like that, it seems like teachers and students use Shader Toy a lot, computer graphics students, and then game developers and people like that. Yeah.
But would you say that it actually stems from the demo scene, the idea for Shader Toy? Was that something that you, when you said you would like to open it up as a community part, is that something that you wouldn't have had as an idea if there wasn't a demo scene beforehand where you had your experiences?
I don't think I had a master plan for it. Like, I'm going to make this thing so that in the future, when shaders become popular, then the demo sceners can do these things. It wasn't nothing like that. It was mostly like, I want to do this online platform. And basically, I naturally added all the elements that the demo scene had, because that's what I knew and I liked. So definitely having the competition aspect of it, like, everything has to be small and procedural. That's why we don't allow people to upload their own textures, so that we are all competing against a very fixed and well-known limits, which helps judge how good of a shader something is.
Mm-hmm.
So there is that kind of limitation aspect, the size limitation, of course, the fact that everything has to be mathematical, the community aspect. That all came from the demo scene, but not as a natural, not as a conscious decision. Like, I'm going to build this thing because that's what I want to. It's more like, it just happened that way.
Mm.
And then, I was very strongly opinionated about opening the code, showing the code to others, the educational aspect of it. That, yes, was of a more conscious decision.
Right. And that was a key aspect, right?
However, it can be secretive.
Mm-hmm.
Is it easier, you would say, for programmers to do something on Shader Toy instead of doing a demo or an intro or something, because it takes much more, I don't know, but that's okay, that's just me guessing. But is it just, do you need a more to have a more red line on a demo instead of doing something on Shader Toy, because it allows you to be shorter in the creative process instead of having to do a full production with artists and graphics and whatever?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I think like putting out a production is really like an heroic effort, I think, right? Like, indeed, you have to first of all have the music, art direction, all those things, and work, plan it, maybe make a script for it, a storyboard. It's a whole crazy process. Shader Toy is a lot more casual. I mean, depends, right? Like, still, when I put a big shader out there, it's not something. I mean, sometimes I do like a one evening shader that I just had an idea for something, or it was an exploration of some math or whatever, and I just publish it and I'm done with it, move on. Other shaders are more like very conscious, more like a demo production where, okay, I want to make this thing. It's going to take me 3 days or a month if I split it over the hours I have to do this thing, because real life still happens. But it's a lot more prepared and consciously planned. But that's me. I think most people it's an in-between where they work on something, there is a challenge they had that they gave themselves. I want to make a ray tracer that is doing these things. And then they publish it. You clean up the code. But yeah, it's not the same as making a demo. That's for sure.
So it's more of a one-man show, yeah?
It is a one-man show, yes. That's right. But you could say the same of 4K intros, 1K intros, 256 and all that.
Yeah, they're two men basically now. Well, they're one man and Virgil. Usually.
Right.
That's how 4Ks work
right,
in this
right.
day and age. One person and Virgil. But it was funny what you say, like Shader Toy like has that competitive aspect, because it doesn't really show when you go to Shader Toy. You said it's more like a gallery, it's more like a showcase.
Mm-hmm. That's as an outsider, probably, if you are in the, there's a group of, I don't know what's the number, 100 people or something, and we are, it's not explicitly state as a challenge. There is no competitions. There are no things like that. Like, we don't say who's the winner of anything. But there is all the time, like, I made this thing, and then someone tries to make something a bit more crazy, especially on the math aspect of things. Like, there was an ongoing thing with solving cubic equations, for example, which is something you need to render some type of primitives and things. And it was like, who could make it the most efficient and more robust.
Right.
It was the same with solving how to render an ellipsoid or an ellipse, which seems like something simple that you would do in traditional graphics. But when you do something, there are some things in Shader Toy that are more difficult to do than in traditional computer graphics. So maybe that goes back to the question of Axel earlier, which the way you do computer graphics in Shader Toy is different to the way you normally do computer graphics with OpenGL or DirectX, where it's an explicit way of doing graphics where you say what things go where. You say triangle here, triangle there, triangle here. And this one is blue, this one is green, this one is yellow, and you paint your stuff that way. Shader Toy is a very different approach. It's more like the computer will ask you, for this pixel, what should I put here? So you construct things in the reverse order in which you would normally describe them, which is it requires the coders to switch a bit the way they think of things. And that makes some computer graphics problems much easier. That's why we can have crazy procedural landscapes in ray matching and things like that. But some other things, which used to be very simple, like rendering an ellipse, now become very difficult because of the maths behind those shapes. And there was a competition, not a competition, but a challenge or a, I don't know how to call it, a small thread of people trying to solve the ellipse thing in the best way possible. But yeah, it's not a core feature of Shader Toy, the competition aspect, but it happens.
It's awesome, though, that you have that challenge of, like, we want to solve this problem, which is kind of competitive because you all want to add, but in this more, like, in a friendlier way.
Yeah, absolutely. It feels a bit like or maybe it's me seeing everything through the optics of competition because of the demo scene. I don't know, but I do imagine that people who are making computer graphics in academia and they release papers, they must have some sense of competition, right? Like, this guy released this paper that solves this fluid solver. Let's make it better. That's a competition to me, even
it's
though
a drive.
It's not stated. It's so.
It's that question, that old, age-old question of, like, the competition aspect in the demo scene with also creating visual art is, like, how well does that gel together? But yeah, would you feel for Shaito not being a super competitive platform? Like, is that an upside or a downside? Would you ever add competitions to it? Or are you like, no, this is the way I want it to be. I want it to be this drive, but not, like, the best shader of the week compo.
Right. I mean, we did try these things. We did organize, I think, four or five times. We did have explicit shader competitions, which were based on three different categories. No, so there were three sub-competitions. One was for size coding, one was for best art, and then one was for best math, I think. And then, yeah, multiple people competed, and then we gave prizes and so on. That happened four times, but it was always a bit like on the side of ShaderToy. It wasn't, we wouldn't put it on the front page. Like, competition coming. It was more like, it was at the bottom of the, on the footer of the website, and we would announce it through Twitter. I normally try to align it with, some demo event. I think we did it once with Gargai and Gloom in NVC in, not the 2008, but some other one a bit later. And then we also aligned them with SIGGRAPH, but it wasn't never like, yeah, in the front page, like, this is the something at the core of ShaderToy. It was more on the side. And
yeah, you don't want it to be the focus. No, I think, no, exactly. No, it's like, it's an interesting thing because it's coming from the demo scene, which is so, like, absolutely competitive. Yeah. Well, to the extreme for, I mean, the Shader Showdown is basically ShaderToy on speed because you have to do it in 25 minutes. What do you think about Shader Showdowns? How do you feel? I think you participated in one, or?
Yeah, I did one. That was a bit of a trap. I didn't know what I was going into when I said yes to Gargai. Revision 2020, I think. Yeah, I think it's awesome. I think that's a beautiful cultural artifact that we have created in the demo scene. It's an evolution. You know, people always say, well, not always say, but people were complaining sometimes, the demo scene is dead, but it's not. There's all these new things sprouting everywhere and growing. Like, there is the shader competitions, there is ShaderToy, there is many other things that I'm probably missing. And I like them. Okay. It's not for me, though. So I have done a fair amount of live coding. I did start in 2010, I think, 2011, in San Francisco with Paul, partner in crime for ShaderToy. And we would go to the clubs, electronic music clubs here in San Francisco with a computer, bring some OpenGL framework that we had and live code stuff. And it became very clear in 2010 that shaders was the easiest thing to live code in front of people because of how quickly you can put things on the screen. But it was very, like, there was no sense of competition or timing, and half the people were drunk, so it didn't matter.
Well, it was flowing with the crowd. You were just think it's awesome that you were probably like adding to like how the crowd was behaving, and you can
it brought
to
the mood.
That.
Yeah. And it was fun, but we did, I think, 20, I think we were doing a gig every other week for a whole year and a half. It was a lot. And I aged a lot. I see the pictures before and after that 1 year, and I look like a kid, and then I look like an old person.
It's the clubbing life. It takes a lot of
years. Yes. And I was taking it seriously, the coding aspect a bit. So I was trying to do my best. And so I did a lot of live coding, but it was never in a context of competition, or I wouldn't prepare anything. I did understand later after the 2020 revision that the showdowns are more about, maybe most people, at least I think, they try to do one effect and they focus on that one effect. And I was under the impression it was more like, let's jam and type things and whatever. And I tried a couple of things and it didn't go very well, but it's fine.
Well, it's very time pressure, of course. It's at 25 minutes, so it's like it's hyper pressurized competitive
coding. And you have
to
train for it, I feel. Or you
That's how it changed. I think when we started doing shader showdowns, it was way more like, let's just code something together. And then now people actually prep their shaders and practice run and see
if they can do
a certain idea. Can I do it in 25 minutes? I've had people indeed tell me like, yo, I practiced them yesterday. I did it in 30. So I hope I can. And so, and I don't know if this is a good or bad thing. I think it's good because I think it people bring their A game, definitely. Yeah, I think I like the shader jams where people, this happens at like online demo parties. I think we started doing that. I think you might have participated in one where there's a DJ playing and people are just jamming for a few hours.
Yeah, no, that was the 2020 revision. It was 1 hour long, I think.
Yeah. And that's chiller because then it's less about, indeed, then it's just people making fun visuals. And that's, I think it's a different thing indeed.
Yeah. But then after watching the recording, I realized that both Gargai and Flopin had stick to one effect for the whole duration of the thing.
Yeah.
Well, I had been improvising at the beginning and then I decided to do something, but it was already too late and I had issues with the sound. But it was fun. It was super fun. And I love it that this is happening, both the improvisations, the jams, but also the showdowns where people really train. I think it's lovely. Like something like that would emerge from a culture like the demo scene and that people train for it. There is these competitions. There is the athletes, the famous ones, the not so famous ones, the attempt to climb to the top. I think it's lovely, all that. Yeah.
Lots of different skills you have to have under pressure and having to memorizing is actually a very big thing in Shader Showdown. Mm-hmm. And would we ever get you in a actual Shader Showdown 25 minute round, or is it just not your thing?
I don't think it's my thing. Because of, I don't know if I have the time to even train.
Right.
I would expect to train at least for 3 or 4 days before the thing, and I don't know if I can afford that. But
maybe you can do a byte battle. Like that's just the 512 kilobyte or 256 kilobyte tick 80 component. Like.
Right. No, but yeah, I mean, I would say no, but if I was there, also if I do it, I would like to do it in person. I wouldn't want to do it again without feeling the crowd and from the distance. Like we did last time.
We'd love to have you back at a demo party in Europe. Absolutely. Like revision. Revision next year if it happens.
Yeah,
IQ live on stage.
Yes. Yes. My family, my wife is Korean. So I only go to Europe every other year.
Right.
Because we have to split the vacations. And then, grandparents have a big priority. But that doesn't mean I couldn't go with a kid.
So, oh, no, but absolutely. Like, I mean, life concerns. But it would be lovely to see you like at revision again and participating. But
it'd be awesome.
If you said that you had you think that Shader Toy is more of a collaborative platform than probably more than competitive. Would you say there's also a culture of mentoring others on Shader Toy? Is that something that you see happen or rather not?
I do see it happen, not a lot, but it does happen. There's a few users who, and me included, who would help or point out what could be better in a shader. It's difficult sometimes to, sometimes it comes across a bit like a harsh, I guess, and not from me, but also from other people, because it's like, oh, you could try to do this other thing instead. Some people, especially new people who are not used to get criticism, very well, they might see like, oh, why are they criticizing my shader? But we are trying to help. But yeah, there's a lot of, back and forth, going back and forth, helping people to improve their shader, especially, yeah, sometimes through the competition, as I was saying, with the ellipsoid and all that, sometimes more directly, like, hey, you could do this way. But we don't have the platform itself, Shader Toy, we didn't build in features in the product to help with that. It's not like you can send a message to someone to ask for help or anything. It's more just the community organically, sometimes helping others.
Right. And you said before that you see the platform a bit of a digital gallery kind of way. Do you see any possibilities to venture further in that direction to make it, I don't know, in the art world or in the digital art world to have a bit of a gallery touch?
Yeah. I don't know. Right now, it's more of it's not like I want or we want Shader Toy to become a gallery officially, but you need a story for the product in your head to if only to help you take decisions on what it should be and what it should not be. It's a gallery kind of one-liner is what we have in mind all the time to take decisions about what do we add and what we don't add. But it's not like we want to officially make it a gallery that hosts artists or anything like that. Related to that, maybe there is the issue of NFTs and all that crap. So we being here in San Francisco, as you can imagine, almost everyone we knew came to us like, dude, you have to put NFTs to ShaderToy. How are you missing this thing? And we're like, well, we are consciously not doing it. Although at some point, I must say that to me, viscerally, intuitively felt wrong. But I also didn't want to have, you know, I know I have blind spots. So I was like, maybe I'm reacting too bad to NFTs because I don't need that money. I somehow managed to build a life around my job. So I'm not struggling. I don't need money from my little shader, but maybe other people do. Maybe it's a good thing to add. So I did ask a few people and everyone had the same reaction as I had. So that kind of confirmed that my intuition was right. And we didn't go for it, but yeah, I asked Flopin, I asked a few other people.
Yeah, I have to figure that in the demo scene, I think that opinion is very much shared.
Yeah.
Like pretty much all over the board, like here and there, there are some exceptions, fair enough. People can do whatever they want, obviously, but yeah, I get that. Because I was wondering, is ShaderToy, it's not like a company, is it like a commercial entity or is it just a hobby project that kind of got out of hand?
It is a hobby project. I mean, we had to set up a company for legal reasons because otherwise we couldn't get donations, which we use from Patreon to pay for the servers.
Right.
For the most part. And then, so we have a legal entity behind it, but there is no such a thing as, I mean, we work on it one night a week if we get lucky.
Well, but you got things sorted. Like, okay, that's important. It's good to know that there is a ShaderToy. If you didn't know this, people listening, there is a ShaderToy Patreon. Support ShaderToy.
That's right. That's right.
Here we go. There's an advertisement because it's an important platform for creative coding, definitely for live coding. And I think, yeah, it showed us. Because how long has it been around?
It's been 8 years, I think.
Eight years. Yeah.
And it's been for the longest time, it has been paid from our pockets. And then only recently Patreon kind of grew and now it's paying itself, which is great.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think it's an awesome project and I've seen it like in different contexts outside of the demo scene. I work in video games and every once in a while people are like, hey, this shader, can we do this in the game? And then the shader toy link is being posted and people are like talking about shit because it's... I think it's so in a demo scene context, how do you feel about that? People say like, oh yeah, you can just steal shaders from ShaderToy and put it in a demo. And
I think people, I mean, if you just steal a shader, I think people will notice. And I don't know, it's just a tool. You can use it.
Right.
It's true that they might have. So I feel like before. Not ShaderToy, because shaders were being used and remarching was being used in the demo scene before ShaderToy or around the same time. I can remember a few intros by Loonies using remarching.
I think it was Keyboarders was starting it, I think. Mm-hmm. It was like this group, late 2010, early 2010.
I think 2006, 2007, that's when we started seeing the first remarched pixel shader style intros. And that was a revolution because we were kind of stuck into polygon land. And because, as I was saying earlier, because polygons have to be placed in screen explicitly, you spend a lot of code just telling the polygons where to go. So I think the most advanced thing we have seen with polygons was maybe Atrium.
Right. Yeah.
I think it was the winner of Breakpoint 2006, 2007. I don't know. That was kind of the farthest you could go, I feel, at least at the time. And then when people started switching to shaders and remarching in particular, there was an explosion. It was like a Cambrian explosion of new shaders. So if ShaderToy helped that, I think that's great. It is also true that now maybe we are overdoing it and there is other things we could be exploring, especially now with compute shaders and mesh shaders. There's this new technologies that we could be using.
Right.
So, yeah.
Because do you feel that it's kind of like shader coding and that creative coding started like eclipsing traditional, classic, like demo coding skills, like indeed, like resource optimization and engine creation? Or do you think like, you know what, it was a new phase and this is a new technology?
In the big picture of humanity, arts, culture, even computer graphics, demo scene is very young. It's 20 years, 30, 40 years. I don't care. 40 years, let's say.
Yeah.
It's not long enough to claim tradition and that we should stick to things. It's an evolving thing. We should move it. We should try things, ideas. It should be like a renaissance of computer graphics. Try things, new stuff all the time, invent. And that should be the power and the strength of Demoscene.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Stuck to this one thing that we accidentally learned to do 20 years ago. And there's not really, I mean, I love all demos. Like when I see Eon, I am amazed. Like, how did they do that? I have never been an Amiga coder, but just by comparison with other Amiga demos, it's like, okay, there's something going on here. So that amazes me. But I also don't want that. Yeah, I don't have a special romantic view, I would say. I guess that's my point about old school stuff.
So you're less the nostalgic person, pushing more towards a new technology.
I prefer new, and even if it's weird and fails, trying new things is always better than sticking to the old stuff.
Because I absolutely agree, and we've had this discussion on this podcast before, like in talking about this. But I think more so as well, not just necessarily sticking to those, but more so those skills as well, like coding skills that people build back in the day that now are less necessary, maybe? Or do you think?
Yeah. And but also happens, like the skills we are developing now, they will be obsolete in 5 years, and that's good.
You have to keep learning. That's what it
is. Yeah, let's invent new things. It means the wheel is moving.
Yeah, that's absolutely. So, no, I agree. And I think that we covered Shader Toy. And let's talk a little bit more about you, because, you have a very storied career. People might know you from here and there. How much did the demo scene experience that you have contribute to that?
Everything. To me, like everything I've done, all the decisions I've taken in life and career, especially career, I guess, it's demo scene. It comes from there. I started in 1998, I started from the beginning, basically being very bad at it. My first intro was a 64K intro, which I showed in 1998 in a big demo party in Spain, in the Basque area of Spain, where I am from. It was the Euskal party.
Ah,
it was 2,000 people at the time already. And I put a big demo in the screen, big for me. It was my big creation after a few months working, and it crashed in front of everyone. Everyone booed. It was really bad. So that was my first.
Is it still around? Can we still see the intro? Is it on Puat?
I think it must be. Yes. It's a F Chaos. So F C H A O S. It must be there, maybe. Yeah. I don't know if it ran.
It's good to know for people that are listening, new people, like, don't be afraid. Like, you have to start somewhere.
No.
And even IQ started with a crashing intro and Oskel in 1998. Like, it's the way to go.
Of course. Yeah. Everyone does. That's why what I was saying earlier, that when people criticize you, and it's fine, it's how you learn. You become better by knowing what you did wrong. So, so demo scene in Spain for a few years, and I went to my first international demo party probably 2001 or something like that. And I started going to mostly Breakpoint, Evoke, and Function. And that was my demo scene life. I did that for many years until 2009. And I made a couple of intros, 64K intros. There was Paradise, and then there was a remake of Plastic's demo from Bonsai. What was the name of the demo? 195/256 or something. It was the first demo that embraced HDR rendering and ambient occlusion and
195/95 indeed.
Yeah, that one, exactly.
They had a fantastic demo, yeah.
And then a few 4K intros, and I forgot what the question was, but So demo scene, I did all of those things, and then I decided to not become an electrical engineer, which is what I studied. I never studied computer graphics. That was self-taught.
Oh, wow.
I was an electrical, I mean, there's enough overlap that it's not that impressive that you go from one, moved from one to the other, but my path was into engineering of, you know, like at the time it was the 1G phones.
Mm-hmm.
So I was trained into building antennas and satellites and things like that. But because of the demo scene, I fell in love with graphics so hard that I had to do demos and graphics. And I joined a VR company back when virtual reality was hot, 2003 or 4, I think. And even there, I would be the one pushing the engine to look good. You know, the customers we had were engineers. We just need to see the red pipes the hot water pipes in red and the cold water pipes in blue, and they don't want fancy shadows or anything. But I was the one there trying to put shadows and occlusion. All influenced by the demo scene, of course. And then thanks to Gargai and Gloom, who introduced me to someone at Pixar. And then I got a job at Pixar. It was also through a very demo scene. So what I showed them was demo scene content. It was rematching and shaders and procedural content. So that definitely decided where I was going to work, my demo scene background and my love for the demo scene.
And they knew, they understood what you made in the demo scene, or how do they?
Yes, they did. This particular person that Gloom and Garga introduced me, Rick Serre, he is a super nerd. He has a very high up position at Pixar, but if you ask him today what's the opcode in the Commodore 64 for this particular thing, he will tell you what the opcode is. He's really like one of those people. So he understood completely what I was doing and he brought me in. And then in the interview, while all the other candidates, I imagine, were showing demo reels and beautiful 3ds Max renders and animation rigs and things, I was showing 4K, 4 kilobyte intros with very matching fractals and weird things, which didn't kind of feel like they would apply to movies in any way. But they got me. And actually, then my first gig inside Pixar was creating the forest for the movie Brave. I don't know how it got translated to different languages in Europe. It was Brave here. And at the time, the computers there, the render farm was made of computers with 4 gigabytes of memory. So they had to render all this crazy complexity and characters with cloth that was made out of threads and hair and all this crazy complex and dense forest. So there was no way to fit all that in 4 gigabytes of memory. So that's where basically I took care, I took the responsibility of making the forest, and it was basically a 64K demo. Everything was procedural. It was C++. It wasn't GLSL, so I couldn't. It wasn't GPU based, but it was basically the same thing that I was doing in demos. So that was the approach. It was a big demo, and when people wanted to, for a given shot, move, you know, some bushes to the right side to make the shot look better, whatever, I would go in the code and change a sine wave and add 0.1 somewhere.
But it's also there's still a merit in that. There's still a merit, especially because it's also bizarre that it's 4 gigabytes, which now sounds like so small.
I know. Any phone has 4 gigabytes, right?
Yeah, cool. It's like, it is, like my MacBook Air has 16 gigabytes of RAM. Like, it's like, what is that? What? Brave is not that old, but no, I guess it is.
Yeah. Well, I also imagine there is... It's very expensive to upgrade, so maybe you stick to the technology longer than
I guess,
the technology can offer, maybe. I don't know.
But it's awesome that they also saw the merit in that and actually gave you that, like, okay, populate our movie with, like, 64 kilobyte code. Like, I think that's...
It took a while to convince them, though. There was some politics going on where... Actually, I first tried raymarching. At the time, I was doing... Shadertoy did exist, or was a year ahead, a way of being online, and then I had done a few... 4 kilobyte procedural graphics using raymarching. So I said, okay, I'm going to do raymarching. But that didn't work at all because of aliasing. You know, in the demo scene, we are fine with big pixels sometimes and flickering speculars, and we are fine. We just put noise on top and we are good to go. But those guys were not fine. They were not okay with 1 pixel flickering. So raymarching didn't work because it was very difficult to make anti-aliased images with raymarching. You had to super sample the thing a lot, and that was very expensive.
Right.
So I had to switch gears and go the explicit way of doing computer graphics, the other way, the traditional way, still procedural. But the first thing failed, basically, for 2 months of research, totally failed. And I was worried that they're going to put me in a plane and send me back to Europe because I was there on a working visa. So the only reason I could stay in the US was because of the job. So, and then I decided to throw everything out of the window and start from scratch by using RenderMan, which was the renderer that Pixar used, which was very strong in anti-aliasing, blending, and this kind of pixel things that are important for the quality of a pixel. They do very well. The renderer does very well. So I embraced that technology and I started from scratch. And when I made the first tree with leaves and grass, the production designer said, okay, this is the thing we are going to make in. And then I was like, whew, okay, good. They are not firing me. And now we can start doing... But I had to show them through pictures. I couldn't, it wasn't like a pitch, like I'm gonna, you know, hey boss, let's do this with mathematics. I have a plan. It wasn't like that. It was like, look, this picture, do you like it? Yes. Okay, now let me explain how I did it. And then
Very clever, yeah.
I didn't know how to do it otherwise, but yes. I wasn't, even today my English is not good, but at the time it was really bad. I don't think I could have gone with a pitch and convince anyone about anything. It was more like, okay, this is the picture. What do you think?
Yeah, no, because I get that it's really hard to, so it's like clever, it's like, this is the result, like, we can do it. And your English is fine, by the way, it's perfect. Like,
which is great, because it's a backwards way of working, I think. Normally, at least traditionally, engineers will pitch a system like, oh, we need a new engine, so we are going to make all this new technology so that you can make your next film or game. And they start from the tech.
Yeah.
And then they try to justify why it works for that given project. And in this case, it was the opposite. First was the art. This is the picture. And now let's work out the technology. Because one thing is to make a tree procedurally, and the other one is to make the whole film in an intro demo style. So I had to work out the tech backwards from the fact that we agreed on the art.
And do you think, were there advantages of being a demo scener in that aspect as well? Of like, did that help you way of thinking or?
Yeah. Well, I mean, all the practice of procedural content and 64K. I mean, it's not like the goal was to make a plugin that was 64 kilobytes or anything like that. But the approach itself led to something that was very small and didn't consume much memory or anything.
But did you have other people on the team that didn't understand that approach that you took and wanted to have it the traditional way in some form, whatever? Or, I mean, were there like political discussions to actually risk going down your route?
There was some little crisis, especially from, so I was in the production team, meaning the people who make the film, put in the pixels and the models and the textures, not in the team who makes the tech. So I was hired as a technical artist and I was reporting to the production designer, not to a engineer, manager or tools person. But when those people knew that I was developing tech in the production side of the fence, that didn't always...
that didn't go down well.
Mm-hmm. But in the end, the last word, I mean, the director of the film and the production designer had, they decide, right? So, yeah. But once that was approved and we had to go out of the traditional way of doing things there, then I did get support and people were excited and happy that these things were happening. And many of the artists as well did use it. So I was the one developing the look, right? I would see the reference pictures, like we want this, but at the same time we want it cartoony and we want this kind of shape. So I would go and code it and all that. But some other of the technical artists then used all that code to help me populate the whole movie with things. And they would also do some artistic work, but some work sometimes by changing the code and things. And some of them became really good at it as well.
Nice.
There's many, Pixar is an interesting place where you have people who, a bit like demo sceners, who many demo sceners can be coders and they can write the music and they can do some graphics. So it's the same there. Everyone have multiple talents and some of the artists used the code as well.
Did you see your approach develop into something else later on when you or left or so? I mean, how long or how much further did you stay at Pixar?
So I used that code for that approach, I would say, because that code is not meant to be reused. It's like a piece of art, you know, like a shader. So you paint it with code, but once it's painted, you next movie, new painting, you start from scratch. It's not like it didn't grow into a framework for making procedural nothing, because that wasn't my approach. My approach was like, this is a painting. This is not something we want to reuse forever. So I used it that way for three movies, and then it got used for another three or four. So I think the last movie where I saw my work on the screen, once I was not at Pixar anymore, was Coco, I think.
Oh, right.
Didn't have much grasp, but the scene in the graveyard had my grasp for sure. I can recognize my procedural graphics there.
So you left a bit of a legacy at Pixar. Nice.
That's so at the family meeting during Christmas, you say, I recognize the grass on the graveyard. That was my work there. What do you do for a living? I create forests. What kind of reactions do you get from that?
So this was, I left Pixar 6 years ago, but during those years, they didn't understand the inner workings of what I do, but my parents have seen me do, you know, Mandelbrot sets and demo stuff since I was 14. So they don't understand the inside of the black box, but they do understand what I'm doing. So, yeah, it's fine. People, I mean, I love the feeling when someone doesn't understand it at first and you explain, and they something clicks in their head, or there's a new connection made, like math, art. What? These things belong normally in totally different subsets of people's heads. And when you connect them for them, normally, yeah, they get surprised. And I love that, doing that connection for them. And even though they don't understand the inside, doesn't matter. For me, just the fact that they can connect and they get to learn that some people use math creatively, that's awesome.
And after Pixar, you went where and what happened after that?
After that, it was Oculus, the virtual reality company. So I joined that in end of 2015. And there we made three films in virtual reality, three short films. Real-time rendered, of course, because that's the only way to do virtual reality still today. So that was a demo, right? It's a real-time graphics with music, with lighting, with all the stuff. I mean, it's not a demo because I don't like to think of demos as like a super set of computer graphics. It's the other way around, right? But
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Sometimes people ask like, oh, someone said in Twitter the other day, like, oh, Unity bought Weta. This is the best demo team ever. And I'm like, what? It's not a demo team. There are similarities, but don't put everything under the umbrella of demo scene. But anyway, just to say that it wasn't making demos, but it was similar enough. And we did three virtual reality films. And then I created a tool, which I never like. I don't like making tools. Give me code and I will put pixels on the screen. I don't like making tools for an artist because then I don't have the joy and the fun of making the pictures myself.
Right.
And I also don't like making the tool for myself. So, but that was an exception. I had to make a tool because I was the VFX supervisor for a film and we were not hitting the look we needed. It wasn't magical as the pitch of the director was telling us that the thing should be. And I made a tool for the artist to paint in three dimensions, not just placing content in 3D space, but really put 3D brushes in space. The tool was called Quill.
Oh, yes.
And I created it for that one film, and then it grew from there, and I became the product manager for that tool and the engineering lead, and it grew. I moved it to Facebook for different reasons, and then I grew the team more, and I was there for another 3 years making a tool for artists, basically, hoping to create something new where the idea there was that virtual reality, you know, as technical as it sounds, because you need headsets and high performance renderers and stuff like that, sounds like very high tech. But at the same time, once you are in there inside the virtual world, the tech disappears because it's you again with your hands making art. There is no sliders and there is no menus and there are no splines to tweak or shadow map biases to change. It's just you painting the thing in your head directly in space, like sculpting. So in a way, it removes technology. And that was the pitch, to give the artist back what they lost when CG was introduced. The idea of creating art with your own hands directly from your head and having to go through all these very technical metaphors of what is a quad? Why do I need to do quads instead of triangles? And what is an edge ring? And oh boy. So that was the pitch. And then we worked on it. And then I left, in order to have time for because when I became the product manager, I basically stopped doing computer graphics. I would still take care of the hardcore parts of the renderer, but I wouldn't have so much fun anymore. And making shaders at night was my escape, my way to do computer graphics. But then baby came and any spare time disappeared. So I was like, okay, I have to leave the job and make time for my demos.
Before we dive to the next step, what would you say about the current status of virtual reality? Because you were in that field. Is that something that you still see as having huge potential, or you've seen it and think it's not going to work? It's not going to work out in the territories that you would see it being used.
Yeah. I think the last part is key. It is going to be used for sure. It has a lot of potential from content creation, as I was saying, for training of people, either doctors or people who have to navigate a power plant to know where the valves are that you need to open when something happens. So there is an industry use of it for very sure, for artists, for professionals of different fields. Now, whether it will make it to the consumers and will we see entertainment in VR? I think yes. This year was very good, apparently, for the Quest 2, which is the headset I have here in my hand, which I listeners won't see it, but this thing is very popular, and it, apparently they sold way more units than they expected. So it's just going to, if it works, but I think it will take longer than the original VCs and investors here in the Silicon Valley thought. Like, they very quickly jump into, this is amazing, let's put money on this thing, in 5 years, the future is here. And it always takes longer, I think.
Right.
But we'll see. I think it's amazing to be inside of an artist's work. Not just watch it, but be inside of it. It's amazing. Yeah.
I remember Quill, and it sounds like Anita said quite grim. She said, like, I don't like making tools, and then you were product manager of a tool for 3 years.
I know.
So yeah. So I can imagine you went like, okay, so that's, I guess, where you said, like, I'm leaving and I'm doing...
Yeah. You wanted to do visuals again. It was a bit of a work of art. What's the word? Like, when you do something because you love the mission, you know, like, I really wanted to see, and I still want to see, and actually the second part of the story is that after I left Facebook 2 years ago, now Quill is back to me. They spin out the product, and now I'm in charge of it again. So the dream still continues. I want to, you know, the Disney's and the DreamWorks to make films in VR, where my kid can be, by the time this happens, maybe she's a bit too old to be dancing with Olaf in the forest or whatever. But I still want those kind of magic stories to happen in VR, but because that was the dream and I was so passionate about it, I did the sacrifice of doing the product manager thing.
The sacrifice indeed of doing like, and that's actually very noble for like, I want to see this happen, do it myself.
There are many things to the story, of course. There is having a salary is important as well.
Yeah, so fair enough, like noble is maybe a bit too big a word, but it's like, I like the way of thinking of like, we have to do it ourselves. We have to make
this. Yeah, because
this,
no one else was doing it. And the Adobe, I did talk to Adobe and Autodesk to, hey guys, would you take over this thing? And they were like, nah, you know, the big dinosaurs of the industry, they react, they don't innovate. So it wasn't going to happen if we were waiting for them. So I thought we had to do it ourselves.
What drives you these days most? Like, where do you see your innovation? I mean, what inspires you? That was what I wanted to say.
I'm right now super hooked with educational content. I made a few videos for YouTube where I explain, I'm going to repeat myself, but the idea of getting people to connect math and art in their brains, I think that's something that should happen. Like, I want more people to know that you can use math creatively. It's not just for accounting or engineering or doing statistics for a drug. There's another way more poetic way of, another poetic use of mathematics, and I want people to know that. So to that end, I published one video so far, and I'm now, as of today, locking the script for the second one and making some visuals where I hopefully... these are videos made for people who do know math. I don't want to teach math, so I need people who already know what a sine wave is, or at least has heard of it, but that don't have never made the connection with art. So I'm making videos for that audience. And let's see how it goes. But I'm very, very passionate.
I saw a video from you, and it's like, it's because you're so passionate about math, which makes it wonderful to listen to you explain it. And it actually really works. My math is terrible, but I love that you are going to make more, because you make it so accessible, because the joy you have, and like, but it's awesome because you can do all these things with it and it works, like, it's fantastic. So I'm happy to hear that you're doing that.
And I don't think I can teach people math. I'm very bad, but if I can just make people aware of that, and then some kid decides to learn math because of that, that's success.
Absolutely.
Actually, you sound like a person who should teach math at university or wherever, because I think if anyone brings across this kind of passion for a topic, not being like, open your book on page 16, that would be the kind of teacher that I would like to have in math at some point.
Yeah, but you are a teacher there, you reach 20 kids a year. If you make a YouTube video, hopefully you can reach 20,000.
Yeah,
or 200,000 or something. But I mean, there is that. But also, I don't have any connections in academia. Like, it's a whole career getting to be a teacher, and these things. I don't know, I can just show up like, hello, I love maths, make me a teacher.
But no, I think it's important that other side as well of like, it's just showing that like, you know, you said like math can be kind of sexy. And I think that is really a thing that's starting to grow. And that's awesome. And I love when, because I see your shader toy shader sometimes go like somewhat viral on Twitter of like, look what is made now. People are like, how does this work? Like how you can check it out and you can see how it works. And that like piquing that interest, I think, and it's also something very demo scene-ish, is like go explore, go make it yourself. And and I think in perspective of all your achievements that you've had in your life, where would you put the work you did in the scene? Like where would you feel like it fits in what you've accomplished, where you are?
In terms of accomplishments, like I never thought of accomplishments, like what I have achieved. It's more like, I still like feel like I just started. Like I'm still trying to.
But you don't have to. Like I mean, you can fill this in however you want, and I think that's a good answer to say.
Yeah,
like,
I don't know. For me, my life was like, I was a nerd, I was a demo scener, and then because of the demo scene, I did Pixar. Because of Pixar, I did Oculus, and now I'm here because of. I mean, it's a continuum, and the demo scene is a big chunk of that continuum. It's like the
right.
It's at least 10 years of active work, but it's always been there. In one form or another. So.
And it's still there. And I think that was a beautiful thing you said. Is like, I feel I'm still learning. Like, I'm never done.
I've heard that before from other people. How do I get views? Do I have to make an intro to my video and then put the video? Or should I put a voiceover? Should I cut to different scenes? I don't know how to make a video.
As you get to learn something new every day. Like,
There was one thing that when I saw you going through all these steps and Pixar and your movie and all the things that you worked on, and during the whole time, I always wished that you would make some kind of production again for the scene where we could see you after Elevated or whatever it was.
I have two pending, two 64K intros pending, which I decided I wanted to make those two already 2010 or 11, like a long time ago. But it's the same excuse everyone will give you. Oh, making a 64K demo takes forever because you can pack anything you want in 64K. That's infinite. In 64K, it's infinite, basically. So, it's a lot of work. But I have two demos I want to make, two intros. One is very predictable, what it will be, given what I have done in the past. The other one is...
Forests.
Yeah.
No spoilers. Let's keep this as a cliffhanger. And also never feel in.
One is the predictable one. The other one, no. So we'll see.
And always take your time. I feel like don't feel that you have to prove anything. Because we would love to see something, but it has to be like it has to be right for you as well. But yeah.
Actually, this whole game is always like we speak about competition, but to me, I'm competing to myself always. It's not really to others. Like. I know I can do better, especially on the art side. I know I can improve this thing. And one of the intros, if I make it, has also this one does have a let's show the world how graphics should be done. Kind of. I mean, this is like a super dream. It might fail day one,
Always aim high. I said like it's very good. Like just aim high to say like I'm gonna shake the ground and then see what be fair, you made Elevated, so you've done it before. So also like no rush, no pressure. Like
we'll see. But these things take a long time. But
absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I was happy to see when you participated at Revision Online with Hoodie and that, like, IQ, like, you did something. I think it's always like it's a welcome surprise because everybody understands that life and work and things get in the way. But yeah, the demo scene is always there. Like,
and it's always there. And even when I make these demos, I feel like I'm making a demo. When I make these videos for YouTube, I still feel like it doesn't go into a demo competition, it doesn't go on Poet, but I'm sitting there, like, I want to make this art, I'm typing code, I'm making it optimal so it renders in real time in After Effects and I can, you know, scrub and do my thing. So I'm making a demo, basically.
You made it your job. Like, that is aspect of, like, making a demo is, like, it's literally that, like, being enthusiastic about making those things, making it happen. And if you don't put it in the demo compo, that, like, we would love to see, like, that you had entered Brave in the demo compo at Revision. Of, like, I made this 64 kilobyte intro. 2 hours of movie, people are like,
But, it would be a very boring movie, though, without music, characters, and...
Yeah, everything else is stripped as well. Just all your tech. It would be hilarious. But, what do you think, like, what do you feel like, is there a thing the scene should do next? Do you have the feeling like there is something that is unexplored that we can... You already said, like, mesh shaders and...
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if I have. I'm not. Yeah, that's a very good question. I think. I mean, Gargai and Gloom and others have been doing a lot of outreach for a long time. I remember them coming to the US to show demos to people, different companies, and all that. Then with things like Shader Toy, you can see the code of the shader, so that's also bringing people. But maybe more opening the code or the demos, perhaps. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I'm just brainstorming right now and riffing.
I think it's happening a bit more. Like, I think we see it, especially in size coding, people are sharing the sources. Shader showdowns, I mean, the sources that's are distributed. Right. And for demos, it's just, I think, although Eon got a write-up, like, they don't give away all the secrets, but there's write-ups and there's sharing. I think we see that happen a bit more. It's less protective of, like, no, I did 78 shade bulbs, and I'm not going to tell you how. You have to figure it out yourself. I think that is slowly... And I think that's good, because, indeed, like, as she said in the beginning of the interview, like, by challenging people to solve a problem with multiple people, you get better results. And it's actually that kind of competition might actually be more fun for the demo scene as well. Let's solve a problem. Let's make something together that people think is not, instead of that ego thing, and maybe that's the thing that is hard in the demo scene. It would be awesome to see that a bunch of people together crunch something.
But I also don't have I don't have a smart answer to what should the demo scene do next. I think opening in general, sharing, not just between the demo sceners, but to the bigger community of computer graphics. That's good. And we have seen a lot of demo competition, demo screenings at places like SIGGRAPH and so on. So it's been happening for sure.
Is there something that you would like to see changing in the demo scene? I don't know, being you coming more from a collaborative effort with Shader Toy. Do you see like the whole group thing or demo scene production kind of way of doing things is something that is outdated by now? Or,
well, I don't know. I don't have it seems to be outdated. I mean, just from seeing what's happening, most demo sceners, they sign their demos with their own nickname, not just with a group. I still, when I did Hoodie, it was still a RGBA production. It wasn't an IQ production. But that's an old school thing to do. Maybe it's because when I started, we had groups. And
are there more members in RGBA, or are you just the only member as well?
No, we were a lot. We were 8 people. And the last demo we made as a group was the remake of Bonsai Plastics demo, which we were like 6 people working on it. So that was the last time. I don't know what that was, 2005 maybe.
I feel terrible now that I just kind of like diminished everybody else in RGBA. My apologies. Like, this is like
no problem. That's normal because we stayed within the Spanish demo scene circuit. We would go to the Spanish demo parties, and when I started going out to Europe, that was when RGBA was basically just me.
Is there one thing that you have not come across anywhere else than in the demo scene that you remember?
Yeah, is there something you feel is unique? Just for the demo scene, that you're like, I wish that other life was like this.
I don't know. I like the demo parties. I miss them.
Accepting disclaimers and cookies and all those sorts of things that you don't have to do when watching a demo.
Right. Yes. Although it's becoming more and more difficult to watch demos. Like, if demos were online and I had to click the cookie button, I would prefer it over downloading an exe that might or might not run if the virus detector had decided that demo is fine or not.
we're getting there now. We're like, we watch it. It's real time at the party, and then at home I'll watch the YouTube. It's fine. And it feels disrespectful, but it's where we are. But
there was a discussion in Poet with Ferris. He was talking about Squishy, his 64K compressor, and I don't know if he was trying to get feedback. I don't remember exactly the context, but I said something like, maybe we shouldn't compress these intros. And maybe the intros won't be so impressive in terms of how much content they put on the screen. Maybe instead of 4 minutes of amazing content, you have 2 minutes. But then 2 times more people will watch them because you don't have the virus issues and all those stuff. So it's a trade to be made there. If we want to open the demos into more people, do we get more people by impressing a few with amazing effects, or do we get more people by impressing a bit less, but a lot more people?
But a lot more accessible to more people and not scary executables that their Windows Defender will delete. Ooh, that's a very interesting question to propose.
Well, I don't know. That was a thought experiment. I was like, well, maybe we shouldn't just... Maybe we should stop compressing these things. And I tend to think that might work it's worth trying, but I don't know how to implement it in the demo scene where suddenly, you know, all the 64K demos will be look a bit slightly crappier just because we have decided this thing. I don't know how you even decide something.
Yeah, the first thing I think is like it would be separate compo is like 64K uncompressed. Maybe, and it's just like, it's just a bit, and actually it's a really interesting take to have of like, what is the difference? And it's kind of how we started experimenting with the 4K and the 8K categories of like, what does it actually give?
And also there's a subtlety there because you can still, so my point was not to compress the EXE itself, the, you know, the, the header of the executable that Windows uses to launch the application and all that. Stop doing that hacky thing that saves 5 kilobytes or something, because these days most of the visuals come from shaders, and you can still compress the shaders without making Windows or the antivirus stuff suspicious of your stuff. So maybe we don't lose as much as we think if we just stop compressing the EXE and we still get compressing the shaders. I don't know. There's a lot of things to explore, and maybe there is something that we get from making these demos more easily watchable.
It's an interesting take, because it's something that people would like, but we don't put all the effort in that we can do, and I like it. I like the idea as a thought experiment of like what would actually change, and what we, because I also can imagine the people that make 64K is like, yeah, I don't want to try it because I can do less. So indeed, maybe just having a competition is like, we do an uncompressed compo for once to see how it goes. I'll ping it to Defox.
What was Ferris' view on it?
I don't know. The conversation didn't go much further because also I didn't do like a very strong case for it. It was just like a random thought I threw there in Poet and disappeared. But yeah, I don't know. I still think what he's doing is super amazing. So it's, if I was making one of these two 64K demos, I would definitely use Squishy. I'm not using any of the things I just said.
No, fair enough. So that's what I get is like, you even yourself would use it because you get more out of it. And that's the question, is like, hey, we should do it separately. Is it worth trying?
We did run an experiment with a 4K intro, right? At some point, I wasn't there anymore. I was already not going to demo parties, but then the 8K category just showed up because of a decision of someone like, hey, what if we open a bit, see how much more content people can get into 8K.
It's 4K was like getting small, and I was like, if we give it, and 16K felt too big, and I was like, what if we do 8K? Yeah. It's twice 4K. How much does it actually give us? And it's still like, we've only been doing it for like 3 or 4 years, I guess.
Yeah. But I see this as an example of something that didn't just grow organically. It was a conscious decision from the demo scene. It's like, let's try this thing, see what happens.
Exactly. That's what I meant when I said it before. It's like, I love actually doing these kind of things and not being stuck. You know, we only do 64K and 4K, and this is what we've been doing forever. It's like, no, let's just shake it up a little bit. And maybe, maybe that uncompressed 64K is a really interesting, because like, how much do you lose, and how much are people willing to put into that?
Yeah. There's that exercise of how much we lose, but also in terms of how many people you can reach. I was making the case that maybe more people can see it because of antivirus stuff, but maybe not. That has to be proven. Maybe
people don't even care, but I think it's the whole fact of like, what if we don't make it riskful? Like, what if we don't, like, what if we treat Windows, what if we treat Windows with respect? Having it not
be good citizens of
fans. What are you doing? What the hell are you doing? Because I've had it all the time when I was doing stuff, and people sent me executable versions, and it was immediately deleted from my laptop because Windows Defender was like, no, not having this.
Yeah.
It's a dangerous file. So I can't watch it.
Yeah,
I can't watch it because it keeps being deleted. So I think, what if we treat Windows with a little bit of respect, and then would it actually matter? But that's an interesting thing to think about. Let us know what you think, if we should do this, and then we'll push it through.
Maybe getting to wrap this up, is there something that you would hope to see the demo scene evolve into, maybe? Or is there anything, are there any hopes that you have for the scene in order to?
I think it will, I'm optimist. I think it will keep going the same way we have the shader competitions and sometimes new categories showing up. I think it will keep evolving. I think, I think maybe having more web presence, like having demos run natively online. There's a lot of WebGL demos already, but more of that, perhaps. But I mean, I don't know. I don't have strong opinions or... I just think new things are good. I would try things instead of getting stuck to tradition, because again, in the big picture of things, 40 years is not really that much of a tradition anyways. And there's more value in trying new things, be it 8K competitions or shader showdowns or being uncompressed 64Ks or who knows what. Just new things, try new things, keep moving, shaking, see where this goes.
And I think it's happening. That's good. Good last words. And I think indeed, people, if you listen and you like making nostalgic stuff on Amiga, it's absolutely fine. Like, please do.
Absolutely, but I love it myself.
Yeah,
but don't hold to it like it's the only thing, the only truth, exactly, the only thing we should be doing.
Right.
The demo scene always started. It always came from like pushing ahead and pushing hardware to its fullest. So let's keep doing that. And I think that's lovely last words to end with. So thank you so much for joining us all the way from the United States.
Thank you. This was fun.
Thanks for sacrificing your morning.
Oh, no. Well, you are sacrificing your night and sleep. Tomorrow morning you have to work. So.
Oh, no.
Yeah, we had to do some things to make this happen, but it worked out. I'm very happy it worked out. Yeah, thank you so much. I hope we'll all be waiting patiently for the RGBA intros that might show up in the future.
don't hold your breath. Yes.
No. As we know, we've learned.
Yes. It might take another 10 years.
But just happy to hear that something is still brewing, and that's the most important part. So absolutely. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you. This was fun.
That was a fun interview with IQ. Lots of stuff.
Yes.
What do you think?
Well, it was filled with lots of interesting things, I must say. I mean, just the fact that shader toy, if you're not extremely active into the community, that I'm not, I'm just a brief observer, I didn't really realize how big it is, the amount of registered users, for instance. Like, that's huge.
Yes, massive.
Yeah, and I mean, it is such a creative thing overall, and it's also interesting to hear the backside of things and how basically he fought for creating a 64K out of the rendering bits for Brave, for instance. I really, really interesting stuff, I must say.
Absolutely. And yeah, I know it's that whole and the casualness of talking about Shader Toy. It's like, yeah, I know this has a giant community and we just maintain it. It's a company now because we have to, but we do it for fun.
Yeah.
It's like wow. So yeah, awesome.
Yeah, and so, it was good to have you guys do the interview, because I think I would have fanboyed away a bit anyway. So it's, yeah.
He's just a normal person like you and I.
I know, but still.
He also goes to the bathroom. Mm. No, fantastic. Thank you so much, IQ, for that and for making time for us. It was super interesting to hear.
And to be honest, by the way, I think that's one of the most fitting aliases in the demo scene we have. I mean, IQ, Inigo Quiles. Yeah, it makes sense.
So I think that wraps it up for this episode.
Yes.
Thank you so much for listening. This show was hosted by Oki, Axel, and Ziphoid, and was produced, mixed, and edited by Gloom and Gargai. They are of sound mind and body and have taken this task on willingly. Special thanks to Scene.org, Scene.Sat, and Bedfellas. Send your questions and feedback to the Zine Radio Show at Scene.org, or contact us on our Zine Radio Show Discord, and do send our questions. Thank you for sending us one already. We love to talk about it. If you like the show, please share it with your friends and give us a positive rating as well. You can find the Zine Radio Show on Scene.Sat, as well as Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts. See you again next time, 12th episode. A year, can't wait for it. See you next time.
Bye. Da tror jag den glitchade. Nu är min CPU crazy.